Woohoo! Welcome to the Some Work All Play podcast. We are so happy to be with you today.
It's Tuesday.
Tuesday!
So pumped to be here, but today's been a little bit bonkers. And yeah. I feel like that was like perfectly summarized. We just did a microphone test and about 30 seconds in, you're like, Megan, just say something normal so we can actually do the test. And I think that perfectly summarizes how our day is going.
You were just making a bunch of random ass noises. In fact, one of them sounded a little bit like a Mario Kart noise. Can you repeat that right here?
Woohoo!
Yeah, exactly. It's when they put on like a power up and they just shoot off. That's exactly what you did.
I'm just giving all of our podcast listeners a Tuesday power up.
Gave me a power up too, even though I got a little bit annoyed in my very serious audio engineer way. It also started in a very interesting way this morning, bright and early at 4:42 a.m. I didn't realize it was 4:42 at the time, but I'm just lying there deliciously in dreamland. And all of a sudden, I get headbutted full speed from my left.
Okay.
What were you doing?
That is a bit of an exaggeration. It was not a headbutt. It was more like a head cheers. We were gently cheersing our heads. I actually don't know what I was doing because I was also deliciously in dreamland. And then all of a sudden, we're just like colliding heads in the middle of the night. I blame it on the fact you were practically on my pillow. We're usually like we snuggle before we go to bed, but we're kind of like two sleeping silos at night. And you were right there.
Wait, you're saying I was practically on your pillow when in actuality, I was on my own pillow? So what is practically, what work is practically doing there?
You were on the crevice between your pillow and my pillow. And so you're practically on my pillow.
I strongly disagree. And when we present this argument to the jury, I will present my burgeoning case of CTE for their evaluation.
I'm glad you went there because I was about to be like, this is why you don't argue with a lawyer. Even a lawyer that doesn't like conflict, this is still why you don't argue with a lawyer.
Well, so we woke up at 4:42. I might have a little bit of brain damage. Honestly, I think a little bit of brain damage might help the podcast. So expect a lot of jokes. It'll be an interesting back and forth.
Because maybe we'll talk slower.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, both of us. This whole energy. I feel like our podcast listeners are going to like it.
That's so perfect. And you woke up and you've been a little bit tired since that 4:42 start.
Oh man, I woke up and my whoop tells me I'm a piece of shit quite often. My whoop was at peak piece of shitness this morning. I actually got a health warning from my whoop.
Oh my
it was
God.
Like, maybe there's something wrong with you, both from a standpoint of heart rate, resting heart rate, and respiratory rate. So that was not great.
Have you ever had a health warning on your whoop before?
I've never had a health warning.
That's really interesting.
It's fascinating. Actually, based on the graph of my resting heart rate trend, my resting heart rate is going to be like 70 by Friday.
Oh, no.
And I'm going to wake up on Sunday morning and just have skull and crossbones. It's going to be like, there's nothing left to measure. You've officially died.
Yeah. I wonder if your whoop, when you wake up that day, it's like, perhaps you should go to the doctor when you're like flatlined for the last 8 hours. It's actually very interesting. I wonder what whoop is perceiving and considering you might have.
Probably like, go get tested for COVID, girl. I'm pretty sure I don't have COVID.
You got a COVID test last week and you were clean.
I'm sure it's probably fine. I'm sure I'm just... I don't know, internalizing all the stresses. I've had a bunch of stress last week. I'm sure I'm just internalizing that.
The one thing to consider, though, is I have licked a number of poles in the last few days. So, my body operates a little bit slower. Perhaps that pole licking is getting to you first. So we have to consider that. But actually, a really interesting use of whoop. And I think something that everyone might be interested in is that this isn't just about a question of like, are you ready to train? It's actually tracking long-term health metrics that might matter. So we really recommend whoop. They sponsor this podcast. So support them and you support us. If you use the offer code SWAP at checkout, SWAP, you get 15% off. The Whoop 4.0 straps are incredible. All of the data issues are good to go. We trust it fully. So totally recommend it.
Kudos for that sales and marketing pitch. I feel like you've only had 15 podcasts. Yeah, that you absolutely have. And I'm really proud of you for that. Yeah,
sometimes we forget. Probably a sign that not their marketing team isn't always listening. But I also think it shows that we're being authentic, that we don't just read ad copy.
I was going to say, well, we've sold a bunch of whoop straps. So I feel like they're going with the authentic over the quantity. So we'll take it. Quality over quantity.
We do have the best listeners in the world. I wonder what we might be able to sell outside of that. Like if we could do an offer code for like sex toys or something.
Ooh, that actually would do real well. I feel like our podcast listeners are like totally primed.
Well, it can operate in two different ways. You can like massage your calves and really loosen things up, or you can loosen things up other places.
And I'm happy. I mean, we can test it out in Pride Reviews. I'm down for that. That would be a fun use of our podcast. It's good podcast research. That's the type of research I personally love doing. But sometimes I override these whoop metrics because I'm like, I feel good. I think it's really important whenever you have a data metric is to be able to like override it. But this morning I was basically just drinking like endless amounts of coffee and my body was not waking up. I'm usually pretty responsive to coffee.
And that's not good because I brew very strong coffee.
You do. It's basically espresso.
And especially today. So, you had a research friend, Dr. Emily Cross, visiting this weekend. So this weekend I tried to mellow out the coffee just slightly because I was like, I don't want to poison a visitor. But I've gone back to full strength. This stuff is like sludge. You can use it as motor oil if you need to, and it still wasn't hitting you.
I should try pouring it in my Volkswagen and see what happens.
Yeah.
But it was not hitting. So then I moved on. So actually in our last race, we won this box of Goo energy gels.
Yeah.
And they were espresso energy gels, which have 70 milligrams of caffeine per gel. And so I was like, I'm going to pull out the next force. Let's see what happens. So I took like half of that and did nothing to me.
Even that did nothing to
me. Did nothing. And usually if I take something like that, I'm just like bouncing off the walls, like ready to go off a ride. And I was like, not hitting.
Yeah, it's actually really interesting because it's a different source of caffeine. I think it's usually green tea extract. I'm not exactly sure in that particular one. But what I've noticed is that when you change caffeine sources, you often get a slightly different hit. So it's something for athletes to consider, even if it's just changing the type of coffee or the way you brew it. It's good to mix up those things like you were talking about with the dopamine last week, but you weren't getting any dopamine from this gel.
Zero dopamine. Also, I loved how you just referred to it as getting a caffeine hit.
Yeah.
We're really emphasizing the point here that caffeine is actually kind of a drug, and it's nice to use it in different.
It is weird that it is kind of a drug. I feel like I should just be sniffing caffeine. But you know, as we talk about things like doping, it is really odd that caffeine is so fully open and out there when it's a plant substance that does mimic performance enhancements that you'll see in other topics. That being said, huge caffeine fan, so you'll have to pry it out of my cold dead hands.
Also, apparently the mice in our house are huge caffeine fans. So the other morning I was downstairs doing some like strength and mobility in the basement, and all of a sudden this mouse just comes hauling across the floor, like practically going full Usain Bolt across the floor. Yeah. And I was like, what is going on? Also like simultaneously horrified. I mean, we live in a farmhouse, so I kind of expect mice, but this was a big mouse.
Did you have a lot of mice growing up?
I mean, intermittently, like, but it was never something that was like a constant.
Well, you can imagine the house that I grew up at, which was also a farmhouse, but, you know, was run by my father, who doesn't have the best attention to detail. And, there was mouse droppings everywhere to the point that I didn't even consider it when they were in my food. I just moved that part of the food to the side.
So gross. So your house is basically run by Stuart Little is what you're trying to say.
Yes.
But anyway, so we were investigating for the source of the mice, and we found that they had gotten into our energy gels. And so these mice, and the reason it was probably running with Usain Bolt was it was running on caffeinated gels. And I was very impressed.
It's very scary that they are harnessing the power of exercise physiology into their extreme cavorting in our house. Perhaps it won't end very well. What are we going to do about this mouse?
I don't know. Actually, I'm like opposed to killing mice. I hate those traps that like snap on mice. They like viscerally bother me. Like I can't retrieve mice from that. So I want to find some sort of way that we can trap the mouse and then release it to the wild. But it's complicated. I've seen ones that like the mice get stuck in this like gel material. And I'm like, that kind of sounds like a torture chamber. Like,
I think it is.
Like gel boarding instead of waterboarding. Yeah, not great.
Oh no. Maybe we can set Addie off on it. I feel like Addie would catch them and let them outside if we taught her how to do it. Do you think we can train her?
I mean, she might. Maybe if we like bribed her with some energy gel. There we go. The circle of energy. But I'm pretty sure we should do a randomized control trial and feed the mice different gels. And there's like some gels that I'm convinced like don't work. And we just see the mice like lethargically going across the floor, like the floor being like, I'm bonking. Where's my electrolytes? Meanwhile, the 70 milligram gel, freaking Usain Bolt.
They had some amino acids in there ready to fucking rock. Okay, so how did you deal with your extreme fatigue today? I think it's something that's helpful for athletes to hear. And I was really happy with when I got back from my workout.
I just went out and had a delightful shuffle, had zero data metrics on the shuffle. So I just went out there and just like ran on the trails and snarfed about. And it was great. And it was such a delightful reminder of the fact that like running can be super easy and very fun. And that's also a fantastic performance stimulus too. As I was out there, I was like, I could probably add 20 or 30 more miles per week of these like very easy shuffles. And I actually think it would be fantastic for my body.
Oh, I think it's fantastic for training in general. And I guess that's one of the hard parts of people that are considering extrapolating this to their own training is thinking about like the levels of volume that might reward shuffling. Like, you know, when we talk about Kipchoge shuffling last week, we were saying, well, he's doing 120 miles a week. Perhaps that wouldn't work if someone was doing 40. But the point is that 40 mile per week athlete can almost always ramp up to 50 or 60 if they're adding it through walk-like running. So you went out there. What did you do? You go straight no GPS from the start?
Straight no GPS. I have a Freestyle Shark watch that I absolutely love. And it brings me those like just like the vibes back to my youth. And I was rocking and rolling my Freestyle Shark watch. Also, what I love about shuffles too is I feel like my brain is just primed to like engage with material. And so I love listening to podcasts on shuffles.
Oh, cool.
And I'm like, I can be out here. I can be boosting my aerobic stimulus. I can be boosting my brain, boosting my joy. This is great. So it was kind of like a revelatory run. And I was like, I should just do shuffles more often.
I love it. Yeah. I mean, I've fully embraced that in my own running life. I've actually started uploading my shuffles to Strava, which I never used to, because it's like, this might not be something that anyone wants to see. It'll just like clog their feed. But people seem to really like it last week, that they saw that, oh, I run at 10 minute pace sometimes. And like, you know, today, meanwhile, I was on the track and felt great.
You
off the
rocked shuttles. It. I was so pumped to see you on the track. I thought it was really cool.
But I mean, I think that that's as much the groundwork for that is laid in the shuffles that I do all the time and the aerobic stimulus I get from that, because I do need to do a little bit higher volume given my trajectory and history than maybe some others. And I get a lot of that volume from going real slow. So I did go to the track today. It was very fun. I'm practicing some track workouts that are going to be given to some SWAT pros recently. So SWAT pros out there, you can check the Strava to see the magic that is brewing.
I was going
to
say, you're being our SWAT guinea pig right now. Yeah. And I'm really grateful for you for that. Also, you're doing a fantastic job of it. And I think it's really boosting your fitness. And yeah. So I'm also excited to see that as well.
I mean, I just logistically, I want to make sure that I test every workout before I give it to someone.
I'm the same way.
You know, because otherwise, like, we don't know exactly how it feels and what we're asking to do. I mean, actually, I don't think any coach needs to be a good athlete at all. I just think they need to know what they're getting athletes into, right? Because otherwise, like, the numbers I could put down on a piece of paper, I could easily tell someone to do 25 miles with 8.642 at marathon effort or whatever. And it's like, that might kill somebody.
I love kind of injecting my own commentary into athletes' workouts. Yeah. So sometimes I'm like, I'm going to give you a shuffle today and it should feel delightful. And then other times I'm like, at rep 8, you're going to be close to impending doom. Yeah. And that is the goal of this workout. Very rarely do I give those, but I feel like it's helpful for athletes to kind of just be able to have the expectation of what the experience is going to be like.
Yeah. So you tell them before or on workouts sometimes, like, this one sucks, or like this, like those types of primers too, sometimes when they need it.
Sometimes it depends on the workout, but then I give little emojis to go along with the primers.
I love that. And so we're just fire.
But I do think, and I was talking with you about this, I think the track can be a useful tool. And I think it really depends on the context in which an athlete is training, especially if an athlete's not an injury prone athlete. We've seen slightly higher injury rates on the track. You're generally running faster. It's repetitive motion. But I think I would love to see you write an article on how do you apply track training and translate that? Like, how does that translate to the roads, to the trails, to other forms of training and vice versa? And I would just love to see you write that.
That's a great idea. I mean, a lot of athletes listening to this might be a little bit shocked, because I have said in the past, no need to be on the track. And I stand by that. There is absolutely no need to be on the track. But what is good about the track is that it takes away all external stimuli. Like, all your form is doing is putting out power. That can be a very good thing, because you can lock into effort levels that are really good. The problem is, unless you're highly disciplined or have a coach right there with you, often athletes go too hard and are pushing anaerobic limits. So a good example would be 10 by 400. A lot of athletes will go out and do 10 by 400 and try at the end, they're essentially pushing their mile pace, their mile effort over the course of that workout. Great workout if you're trying to be Roger Bannister operating in an anaerobic setting to run a sub 4 minute mile. Terrible if you're a long distance runner and those anaerobic stimuli push back against aerobic development. So what I did today was 5 by 600, 400, 200 with 200 easy recovery, focusing on smoothness and sustainability, keeping my heart rate in control. So it was a great workout because that led to fast paces and high power outputs. But it was also a great workout because I didn't look at the watch after the first set of intervals, because I knew if I was looking at the watch, I would try to impress the watch rather than to try to impress my physiology.
I loved how you just described that. I would try to impress the watch.
Yes.
As opposed to the watch, I would try to be impressed by the watch. It's like you're being so kind to your watch, which I think is like the perfect David Roach narrative. That's how you are to everything. You're just now going to be kind to inanimate objects. It's great.
I definitely wouldn't headbutt this thing at 4:42 a.m. So we also wanted to talk about what we do after runs, because I think this might be a little bit relevant. We actually started talking about this last week when our recording didn't get picked up. So good to get it out now. So this weekend, as I said, Dr. Emily Cross was here, an amazing researcher that's doing research with Megan, along with videographer Tanner, and they're doing some very cool research projects. And they validated our approach to post-run fueling in terms of taste. We have never talked about it because it is kind of gross sounding, but it is delicious tasting.
It is so delicious. I find I get in from my run and I'm like in a rush to do my strength, to do my mobility, to shower and get down to and what we do post-run. Woo! It's called protein cereal.
Yes.
It's so good. And so what we do is we have a base of water. And it's very important you get this order correct. Actually, Tanner messed up the order this weekend. And I was like, I'm worried about how that's going to taste. So you start, get a very large bowl. Find like the largest bowl in your house.
It could be a serving bowl even.
I was going to say, a salad bowl. That's great. Mixing bowl. And fill it with water. Then put in protein powder. We actually love Vega protein powder. Yes. Fantastic. It's clean, not sponsored by them, but it tastes good. And we just like totally trust the brand and mix the protein powder into the water. And then this is the important part, mix multiple cereals into it. So it's kind of like the protein powder serves as like the milk base and then multiple cereals in there. And it's the total. I'm all about flavorgasms.
Yeah.
And it's a flavorgasm in the mouth.
You're getting wet in the mouth for this. That was gross. But to add on, I do a full rounded scoop of Vega protein, which ends up being like 35 grams of protein. You can do anything like that. And then with the two cereals comment, I don't even get out of bed for less than two cereals. It, for me, it's two plus. So today we've been into Corn Chex and Apple Cinnamon Cheerios, but we mix it up as we go. I think it's really key to have a lot of really fun crunchies because that's where your carbs come in. You're loading up there.
Ooh, I love that you highlighted the crunchies. I'm all about crunchies.
Yes.
So I like actually two cereals and a source of granola because I think the added crunch, and you just looked at me like I was weird. You're like, Megan, you have 10 heads right now. Don't talk about granola and cereal. But I love the combination of like the smooth cereal and then throwing in the granola texture, and it's great.
I like it too. It probably adds a little bit of treasure at the bottom as it sinks.
Ooh, treasure.
Yeah, I sometimes even put in nuts like cashews or peanuts.
That's gross.
What? Wait, hey, I didn't judge your granola and you're judging me for my nuts.
I'm 100% judging you for your nuts. That sounds weird, but yes, I am.
Oh, Megan judged me for my nuts. This is bad. But Chex, I think, is key. One of the cereals has to be Chex. One, because they're delicious and gluten-free and offer a lot of delicious carbs that can fuel your next workout. And two, because it makes for the greatest puns of all freaking time.
Of all time. I mean, I've been getting you at this point birthday Chex for many, I think for 8 years now. We've been going on a birthday Chex theme. Anytime it's your birthday, I'm like, birthday Chex, birthday Chex, 100%.
I love that. Or the Lonely Island thing. I just had Chex and I'll never go back to the not having Chex ways of the past. I think that basically all of that is really good. So big summary here. Is a big bowl, a big spoon leads to big freaking gains. So maybe try that, but you don't need to do it as protein cereal. We're just using this as a segue to talk about protein more generally and why it's a main focus of what we ask athletes to do, all getting back to how they adapt to the context of training, especially harder sessions over time.
We've touched on this before in other podcasts, but whenever an athlete comes to me and is like struggling with adapting to training or niggles, like, okay, how much protein are you consuming? Yeah. Like, let's take a look at this. Let's evaluate this. And oftentimes that actually does become the answer. And, you know, athletes start feeling better within a week or two of increasing protein intake. Do you have, and this is a question I get all the time as a coach, and I generally answer it in various ways and then often refer out. Do you have a general protein recommendation that you give to athletes in terms of like, how much should I could be consuming per day? Like, does this depend on like male, female, athlete type, et cetera?
Yeah. So I think specific recommendations have to come from an expert nutritionist. So we always recommend that. And we have some that we've worked with a little bit to develop a blanket recommendation because I don't want to dig down into the weeds too much with each athlete. I think that as we're going to talk a little bit in a little bit about the University of Oregon, it's not necessarily healthy for a coach to do that. But as a blanket recommendation, I say 100 plus grams of protein a day, regardless of who you are. I think once you start pushing huge levels, it gets a little bit at the margins of human performance that I'm not an expert on. But we see this matter so much for athletes over time. And I think the dialogue on it can be a little bit unhelpful in that I remember a few years ago, there were a bunch of articles and people on social media saying things like society overemphasizes protein and all of this. It's like, actually, running is a breakdown sport, very similar to things like weightlifting. You would never hear that concept thrown about in a power sport. Like in weightlifting, they're having a ridiculous number of protein. Obviously, we're not doing that to our bodies, but we are breaking it down. And if we're not giving it the tools to build back up, especially if we grew up in a context where we were eating a substantial amount of protein like I was, it's not good. And we see that all the time in coaching. And how does it manifest, do you think? Like, what are you seeing in athletes that might be a little bit low protein, particularly like after activity?
I think one thing, so oftentimes vegan or vegetarian athletes can just be harder to get in protein sources. So I think I see that quite often. I see, you know, in athletes that are low in protein, just feeling fatigued, feeling tired, not adapting as well as I was mentioning, and just like kind of constant little niggles. I think for athletes, often the timing of nutrition matters a lot. And there's some really interesting studies out there. But I love what you said about the idea that like a couple years ago, society was like, oh, there's too much emphasis on protein. And what I think is fascinating about like the nutrition community and like the overall nutrition trends is that I feel like protein, fat, and carbs kind of like cycle in terms of like how much we think about their benefit. And it's like they're all important and they're all always going to be important. And as society, we're just cyclically going to think that like, oh, protein is bad or oh, fat is bad or oh, carbs are bad. And it's just going to rotate.
Well, I think that points out a great point. We're saying that all of it is great. We're just saying that we see athletes undershoot protein more often than they undershoot the other stuff. At the core of it, it's always eat enough always. This actually reminds me of a little bit of story from last week. So I had finished a workout and I was at a parking lot and I saw this guy finish. And as I do, as I'll also do at like a sauna or whatever, we got to chatting. And as we were chatting, I asked him what he was doing that day. He told me a threshold workout. And then he described doing double threshold workouts 6 days a week.
So what?
A threshold workout in the morning, a threshold workout in the evening, something like 1-3-8-8-3-1 or something like that. Repeating the same workout over and over. Very fascinating, kind of using some of the Norwegian principles and putting the dial up to 25 or something, like excessively turning up the dial. But it's interesting. And I asked him, okay, how have you not broken down in that process? Because I was just direct. I was like, that's not smart. How have you done that? And what this athlete told me, who's very good, is that they've been doing 60 grams of protein after their runs.
Okay, that's wild. Yes. But also my question is, can you actually, I don't think the body is like primed to absorb 60 grams of protein. Like, did he factor that into his consideration?
Yeah, so this athlete was very smart and science driven. They're taking like enzymes from kiwi or something to help them break down the protein. That being said, we do not recommend that at all. And I think the science does indicate around 30-ish with a little, maybe a little more depending on the person, is kind of the limit you want like to focus on at once. But it points out that this athlete, at least, it helped them in a way that it won't help others, but maybe it's because otherwise they'd be undershooting it tremendously. So we love Vega, which is like a pea-based protein, but anything works. Like I would just say you probably want to make sure that like you're not doing, I don't know, bacon every day and your cholesterol shoots up, because I've also seen some high cholesterol numbers recently.
Or some of those, sometimes as we're waiting at 24 Hour Fitness, we check out their like supplements and their tubs of protein. And some of those have some wild ingredients in them.
Oh my God. I saw one that had 1200 calories per scoop.
What?
Yeah.
That's do you know what the size of the scoop was?
I think, it said a heaping scoop. So I don't know how that can be a serving size, a heaping scoop. I feel like the FDA should not have approved that. It was also right next to the sign at 24 Hour Fitness. It says, hey, please, kindly, don't sell steroids in our gym.
I know, I pointed that sign out to you the other day. I was like, this is weird. Yeah. It's interesting that they're talking about that openly in the gym. Okay, but actually I was doing some research on protein, and there was an incredible study that came out recently in 2021 in Cell Reports. And it was essentially breaking down the timing of protein, which I also think is a really important part of this discussion as well. And the idea of like thinking about like, when are our bodies like synthesizing and using this protein the best? And what I love about this study is that it actually had two different models and two different arms of the study. So it recruited 60 women and they had them eat protein. So high protein, there was two groups. One group had high protein in the morning and lower protein in the evening. Yeah. And another group had low protein in the morning and higher protein in the evening. So it flipped it. And then I wanted to look at like, okay, how are these women doing in terms of like strength development and resilience? And then in addition to that, and this is what I love, they also did a mice study at the same time, because they're like, we want to look at the causal mechanisms. Like how is the body synthesizing protein? Is there anything that we can knock out in terms of genes and better understand these protein pathways? So how cool of a study design is that?
That is so wildly cool. Do you know what the women were doing with their strength? Was it like just normal resistance training?
One of the outputs was, it wasn't like high strength training. Yeah. So one of the outputs that they were measuring was grip strength. So it wasn't like these were like highly trained athletes that were going to do strength, but there probably is some underlying interaction between physical activity and how someone is absorbing protein.
I noticed that studies usually either use grip strength or like knee extensor strength, which I guess would be the leg extension machine.
Yep.
Probably because they're the easiest to like make minor changes on and measure.
It's very easy. But essentially what they found is that ingesting protein in the morning, there's like a morning block, had stronger impact on muscle maintenance and growth. And this was both in humans and the mice. And so they're like, okay, this is really interesting. So their theory was that maybe this has something to do with the circadian rhythms of the body. So what they did, and this is what I was like blown away by, is that there's what we call clock genes in muscle cells. Wow. And these clock genes help regulate like growth, metabolism, restoration in muscle tissue. And they wound up knocking them out in the mice. And what they found is in the mice that had the knockout cells of the clock gene, it actually eliminated the effects that they saw on protein synthesis and on the effects of having like stronger muscle development after consuming breakfast in the morning.
Wow.
So their theory was, okay, like there's something in this pathway that's causing the protein synthesis to better happen in the morning.
So what is the big takeaway then for athletes? I mean, I think it's fascinating that they're knocking out genes in the mice. I don't know exactly what that means aside from my pop science knowledge, but I can guess based on context clues what they're doing there. What do you think the takeaways are for athletes or thinking about future research or other topics on protein ingestion?
So I think the big point is that muscle protein synthesis is really important in that there's these genes that regulate muscle protein synthesis that are heavily active in the mornings.
Okay.
And that it's important, I think, when you're having breakfast, like, or even post-run, like anytime within that like 5 a.m., 6 a.m. to 10 a.m. window, have some protein during that time, because it's when the body is primed to develop, to have protein synthesis and really restore the muscles.
Interesting.
And I think that's super cool. Also, I think there's a ton of work to be done. So this field is called chrononutrition. So like, what is like the timing of nutrition?
Yeah.
And I think it's going to be so cool. There's going to be like a lot of explosion in like nutrition research coming up related to this topic.
Have too much protein, you'll have an explosion in nutrition coming out the other end. And I think it's fascinating and something that perhaps in my coaching, I need to think about a little bit more, because I wasn't aware of this research at all, is talking about not just the quantity of protein, but getting it some in the morning to start your day. Mm-hmm. And then particularly like throwing in some after exercise and really focusing on not just giving your body what it needs over the course of a day, but giving your body what it needs when it needs it. And perhaps that's what we're seeing with the protein cereal. So when we say that, like, this is, we've tried everything over time. And I keep coming back to this, that every single time I do this, my recovery rates skyrocket and my ability to absorb training increases a ton. Obviously a ton of variables there, but maybe what I'm seeing is I'm like those little mice, those little super mice in that study that, you know, are dealing with these clock genes.
What I think about is fascinating about this too is this study looked not only at the quantity of the protein, but also the quality of the protein sources. And what I like about the protein powder is there's a ton of branched chain amino acids in the protein powder. And it's a great way to get that in to ensure that you're having both the quantity and the quality of the protein. And I think that's also important right in the morning as well. The other point that I love on this topic is that, so when we're thinking about these clock genes, they, you know, they're happening in the circadian rhythm. And I think actually when we think about nutrition in general, like having some sort of, and this is where like, I'm not about like, you know, having really strict diets or really like, you know, having this like set feeding schedule. But I think like having some pattern to a feeding schedule during the day. So just like kind of like I eat breakfast at 8 a.m. I have, you know, lunch at noon. It actually really helps the body like synthesize and metabolize these nutrients that we're feeding it. And I think it's something interesting to think about.
I love that. And with the caveat that the whole point here is for it to be fun.
Yes, I was going to say food is fun. Yeah. And whatever schedule you can derive so that food is fun, I think is an awesome thing.
Yeah, and whatever, to get down to. That is the baseline important thing. And when we say we're doing protein cereal, the reason is because we fucking love it.
I was going to say it's fucking delicious.
It's the greatest
fucking
thing.
Magical.
It is, yeah. Oh my gosh. That we need to create our own protein source that says just fucking magical.
That's going to be the name of it.
It would be so good. And why we're talking about protein is that it all gets back to giving the body what it needs to adapt. So much of training theory throughout time has focused on sources of stress, like workout structure, weekly miles, even things like, you know, nutrition interventions. It's all different types of stress. Instead, what we really want to focus on, and there's people at the cutting edge of this, like Alan Kuzins, who we've mentioned before, that are focused on the quality of recovery and how you're actually adapting to the training you're doing. And in fact, actually, we were watching a football game the other day with the Tennessee Titans, and Derrick Henry, their big running back who has defied all wisdom with how many carries a running back can get. They were talking about, he says that his entire life is structured around becoming better at recovery. And that's the reason that he's been able to defy these curves. And I bet when we're talking about the age curve, we also kind of have to think about not just the stress we're providing, but how are we adapting to that stress?
What I think is curious about the age curve as well is a lot of the age curves that we've developed have been from like decades ago. Yeah. It's like we have these like traditional age curve models.
Interesting.
But I think when you think about like where we are now, a lot of our recovery tools have improved. Like we didn't have Theraguns. We didn't have Whoops. We didn't have all these different tools to be able to measure recovery. And I think like, I think that might be a big reason why we're seeing people push the age limits and really like truly improve into like 50s and 60s. And I think it's super cool. But I think it's also a reflection of the like increased recovery tools that we have.
Yeah, let's break that fucking curve. And thinking about athletes on a whole, you know, all of this is mediating things like inflammation. And the complications here for training that are going to, this is going to get us to the bigger topic of the day, is that often we're seeing outlier physiologies and interpolating from those outliers into training theory more generally. Those outliers could just be genetic, or it could be things like doping, which has been rampant among a lot of the places where we've derived training theory in the past. Or it could just be weird little quirks about our bodies.
Actually, speaking of outliers, so you just did a 23andMe test.
Yeah, I did.
And I was fascinated. Also, I was impressed that you did the 23andMe test, but I'm pretty sure, and this is my theory, so you don't love your blood being drawn.
No.
So when you saw that it was a spit test, you're like, oh, heck yes, I can do that. I'm going to spit in a tube and send it back. That's really easy.
Spit I can do, semen I could do, blood I can't do.
Actually, so this reminds me of a story. So a couple of years ago,
not the semen.
Okay. We haven't measured your semen yet that I know of. A couple of years ago, we got approached by a microbiome company and they were like, can you test out our product? We're like, sure, this is really interesting. So as part of the product, you poop, or like you scrape poop into a test tube, which sounds really gross as I'm describing this.
I would have preferred semen, honestly.
That'd be interesting. That'd be fun. And so we sent them the tubes. And I guess the like something happened with the company and it was they never processed it. And so my mom, who was living at our house at the time, opened a package that was a return to sender. And she just opened it up and it's two of our poop tubes, which had been in the mail for like 6 weeks at this point.
So UPS person, sorry for that shit return to sender. Gosh, that's a hard job. But so for me with my 23andMe, I came back with a gene variant for hemochromatosis, I think that's how you pronounce it, which is hyperabsorption of iron. Usually, even when you just have one gene variant, corresponds often with higher hemoglobin levels. I don't know because I haven't had blood work done, but it would explain a lot about how I respond to altitude. And it's interesting to be like, oh, well, a lot of my training thing, maybe when I'm feeling that track workout, I'm feeling a little bit of bonus red blood cells. And the importance of understanding that each athlete is an individual. And in designing training for an individual and in designing these adaptation processes for an individual, we need to make sure that we're never, ever interpolating from outliers, which gets us to the University of Oregon. So this article is really scary, right?
It was horrifying. Yeah, so horrifying. I read this and read the quotes and I couldn't even get over it.
Yes. So if you haven't read it, to summarize, it's by journalist Ken Go in the Oregonian or something like that. And it details the University of Oregon program through 6 anonymous female athlete sources who describe this culture that involves constant DEXA scans, which are these really complicated medical procedures or medical scans, as we're going to talk about later, multiple times per year, using those to do training interventions based on body fat composition and other things like that. So before we get to this topic, just a content warning that this could be triggering for some athletes, this type of discussion. We're going to try to do it in a really compassionate and open way. And we're going to talk about why this is wrong and why all of our athletes from beginners to pros don't do this shit. We're, you know, eating enough food always and letting that drive the process. That being said, if you feel on that side, you might want to skip this part of the discussion.
And the other thing too is this also referred, David, you wrote an awesome piece in Showrunner Magazine on this. I got to read and edit this morning and I just was like smiling as I was reading you, like just you highlighting how important this topic is and how important that we speak out against this topic, and really proud of you for that. And I think as we go through this podcast, we're going to break this topic down into 4 points and why there's 4 issues that are wrong with this idea in general. Yeah. So the first one being that athletes are not math equations. The second one being that this approach overall is just medically irresponsible. Yeah. And we'll really dive into the details of why that is. The third point is that this is actually just informing bad training interventions. Like, yeah, I don't think this has a long-term performance benefit. And the fourth point is that there's a strong outlier effect here and an outlier bias that we're seeing. Yes. And so we're going to dive into all those points and also break down like more of the details of what this report found.
Yeah. And why this is important to talk about is because, okay, at the University of Oregon, this stuff we disagree with has been happening with for a long time. I think this article is going to make it stop. But every single athlete is playing out these types of questions in their heads. Like, we might not talk about it, but it's there. And so hopefully by opening it up, talking about us as athletes and as coaches of some of the best in the world, that like why we disagree with this, not just from a perspective of like happy humans, but also from a perspective of world fucking champions. So starting with the first thing, which is athletes are not math equations.
And I was horrified. So I was going through and reading this article and I was kind of like scrolling through and then on first read, and I caught the coach's quote from Oregon. Yeah. And that was when my jaw fully dropped. And so this is what the coach said from Oregon when questioned about this practice. "Track is nothing but numbers," he says. "A good mathematician probably could be a good track coach." Oh. And I read that and my heart sank, because I know so many female athletes that have been through the ringer in track programs. Yeah. And track is about psychology. It's about supporting teammates. It's about so much more than just numbers. And I would argue that like that's also from a performance perspective. Yeah. As well. Like this is not about like, no, it's just not about numbers.
And physiologically, it's not about numbers. You think the cell to this coach, you think the cell gives a shit about whether that 400 split was a 66 or a 67? It has no clue. You know, the addition of all of this chemical context over time creates an adaptation stress that might then lead to performance over many years. But in the small term, it means nothing. Same goes for body fat percentages or whatever. Someone needs to be healthy to pursue that that reality of what they're actually capable of, instead of trying to tinker at the margins, acting like an Excel sheet can plan training for complex humans. It's just not the way it works. But I think what it does point out is the scary reality here is that if you control for just a few variables, it can feel like it works that way. It's the truthiness where you feel it in your gut that this should be true. And that has been pervasive in track for way too long.
Okay, so I'm going to add on to that point, but also I wanted to highlight here. So I was scrolling Twitter yesterday and I also saw, so UW, which is a Pac-12 opponent, like created this awesome Pac-12 rivalry with their like summary quote. They said, "Coaching is nothing but relationships. The numbers have meaning only when presented in the context of shared goals and trust." And it's so cool to see another Pac-12 school stepping up and being like, no, this is not how we do things. It's not about just the numbers. It's about these shared relationships. It's about psychology. It's about so much more than that. And I thought that was really empowering.
Yeah.
But also, so getting back to your point on variables, I'd love that you brought up the idea of variables. And I think for me, when I think about this, it gets at the idea that these coaches at Oregon were treating weight as an independent variable as it relates relates to performance, to so many other different things in life. And it's like, actually, no, weight is a dependent variable that depends on so many other things. Like, you know, weight is a summary of health and all these other different things, but it's not the one variable that you're trying to intervene on.
Yeah. So we mentioned this in the article, and I think it's worth a little bit of a step back because it can be kind of easy to brush over. So independent variable is the variable that gets changed and then alters the dependent variable. So as Oregon was doing it with these DEXA scans, they're changing these little, they're tinkering with weight as the thing that then drives performance. Any coach understands that's not the way it works unless you are zooming in on such a small scale with such young athletes that you don't actually give a shit about what they're able to do long term. And so the point being, when we're talking about weight, what we're actually talking about is training, stress, nutrition, genetics, all of that layered in with recovery and everything else. What that spits out is a number on the track and is perhaps a number on the scale, but neither of those are the ones that are the thing to start with. That always comes with treating your body well, with providing love to yourself, working the other direction. As I said in the article, it's like trying to use a wood chipper to turn mulch into a log. It's just not the way the body works.
I think the main summary point there is the idea that, like, if you're changing body composition, you're not driving performance variation with that.
Yes.
And I think that's like the key summary and the key point that we're highlighting here. I would, and I think listeners may be thinking about, like, okay, like, what are the situations? Like, I think what's important at Oregon is they were doing this as an institutional program. Like, they were creating this institutional policy that all athletes were having these DEXA scans and having their body composition measured. And I think what's really dangerous about that is it's creating an institutional approach in something that should be an individual approach.
Yes.
And I also disagree with this from an individual level, but I would like to add the caveat that sometimes, and like, I think about this as a physician, is like, sometimes changes in body composition are an important, as again, it's an important dependent variable to understand what is going on with the body. And that's where, like, you know, I think sometimes it is helpful to have a DEXA scan on an athlete to couch this in terms of, like, especially an athlete who may be losing weight. It's like, let's get a DEXA scan. Let's understand where things are. And let's talk about this in the context of performance and longevity. And then I've also worked with athletes too. Sometimes, like, you know, and if an athlete comes to me with, like, elevated lipids or cholesterol levels, or has, all of a sudden has changes in body composition that don't seem right to reflect health, that's when it's time to, like, refer them to a physician, a nutritionist. And I think it's so important though, as that these topics are not handled by coaches, that they're referred out to nutritionists and physicians. And there is a time to talk about it, but it should never be done on, like, this institutional approach.
Yeah, it's so true. And I mean, it's not a coaching question. It's a health question. It's a medical question, which is why your perspective as a doctor is so fascinating, because, like, the coaches that don't understand, that are looking at such a narrow myopic view of performance, should not be the ones that are then telling athletes to alter their bodies. That's a question for doctors. Like, if I see an athlete that might say, come to me with high cholesterol, I'll say, like, have you talked to a nutritionist about this? Can we talk to a doctor about this for health? Similarly, you use DEXA scans in training, and you've told me about is that sometimes you'll use them to actually do the opposite, where it's like, we need to increase your body fat. So there can be a time and a place for this. That being said, it gets us to point two, which is that 3 DEXA scans per year is probably medically irresponsible in most cases.
I would say it's probably strongly medically irresponsible. So I do, a lot of my research involves doing DEXA scans, and DEXA scans come with, I do the consent process for DEXA scans, and I walk through the amount of radiation exposure that athletes have from DEXA scans. And I'm kind of flabbergasted, to be perfectly honest with you, with why they're choosing DEXA scans, repeated DEXA scans per year, to measure body composition when there's other ways to measure body composition that don't come with radiation exposure. Yeah. So to me, that was, like, medically irresponsible, just using DEXA scans as a metric. And it's clear to me, so, like, DEXA scans can be a helpful measurement of bone density. But what I find interesting about bone density is that bone density changes over such short intervals that if you're measuring bone density in this short period of time, the changes in bone density that are accruing over the short period of time are often smaller than the measurement error that you see on most DEXA scanners. So it makes no sense to me personally why you would be doing this many DEXA scans per year.
Yeah, and you do a ton of them, right, in your research. I mean, we're not going to talk about your research specifically, but to give people an idea of Megan's expertise, like, how many consents have you done on DEXA scans over time?
I have probably seen or performed, like, 350 DEXA scans.
Yeah.
So it's a lot of DEXA scans. But I think, you know, the osteoporosis, like, a lot of the protocols for osteoporosis recommend DEXA scans once every 2 years. Wow. If that puts into context, like, how challenging these frequent DEXA scans can be. And so I felt that was medically irresponsible, in addition to some of the medical recommendations they are providing. So, for example, some of the medical recommendations they are providing were for athletes that didn't have their menstrual cycle to lose even more body fat, which seems to me, like, wildly irresponsible from a longevity perspective, even from, like, current health perspective.
And from performance perspective.
From a performance perspective too. Yeah. all of it just seemed medically irresponsible to me.
And we're going to talk when we get to the outlier effect about that specifically. And one thing I was just thinking about, you know, this is not Salazar, right? Like, this isn't abuse in the same way, but it does have some like hints of that in the context of Salazar was also using medical procedures, things like IVs that might have been in the gray area in very weird and illicit ways. And so I think it's something to look at if you're an athlete or if you're a coach. Like, don't go trying to tinker at the margins of human performance because those are variables you can control, because so often that leads to bad places, as we saw here. And so this is the money quote from the coach that was the most horrifying for me of all, just because I think about all the downstream impacts this will have on people's long-term health and happiness. So you want to read that quote or should I?
Sure, I can read it.
You're the pro reader.
When we get the numbers from our DEXA scans, we have an Excel spreadsheet that we can plug the numbers into, hit a button, and it gives us a starting value for a training program. And I read this quote, and first of all, my coaching brain went to the point I was like, what numbers are they even solving for? Like, yeah. I couldn't actually do the calculus to be like, well, how is this actually going to matter from like a training perspective, performance
and
perspective?
And that's the scary part, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Because they're not seeing changes in bone density. What else are DEXA scans looking at? They're looking at body composition.
But that's what I'm saying is like, even if you're plugging that body composition into an Excel sheet, it's like, I don't understand the training metrics that you're solving for.
Well, neither do I. But the point is they're starting from that point. What a weird starting point. I mean, when you talk about the Butterfly effect, you're talking about these initial conditions inform the final whole as applied through this thing we don't really understand about. So the initial conditions at Oregon were body composition. That's gross. That's wrong. It makes no sense scientifically. It makes no sense when you understand exercise physiology. And it informs the third point, which are bad training interventions. So from that point, they're starting to do things like Megan said, making athletes reduce their body fat when they already don't have their period. The other thing they were doing is increasing cross training levels to reach whatever standards these were, changing their fueling in ways that were unhappy. And anyone who understands running or medicine or just being a human on any level kind of sees that what you're doing is you're lighting a bomb under each one of these athletes. For some athletes, the bomb might go off tomorrow or it might have gone off last week. For other athletes, it might go off in 5 years, but that bomb's going off at some point.
And I think actually that bomb ties into the fourth point, which is really important. It's the context of the fact that they're basing these numbers and basing these equations off of what seems like an outlier effect.
Yes.
So they're referencing Olympic champions, world champions, NCAA championships in these math equations, but those are outliers.
Yeah.
So, you know, as we talked about earlier, like there are going to be genetic outliers in body composition, in even like things like bone density, in the ability to, you know, have low body fat and get a menstrual cycle. And the human body responds to all of these different variables in different ways. And if we're creating this equation that's based off of how an Olympian responds, it's not going to respond to most of the team.
Well, and that's the scary thing about the time horizon, right? So if they're solving for the NCAA championships in 6 months and they're working backwards from an NCAA champion, they're going to try to be making everyone fit these molds that normal people don't fit into. And by normal people, I also mean outliers that are just a little bit less or different types of outliers. What I always say is like, if you throw 10 eggs at the wall and one doesn't break, that doesn't mean that we should all throw eggs against the wall or blame the eggs that break for breaking. The point is they're just freaking eggs and you don't want to be throwing them against the wall. But the problem is there are people out there that will have responses to these types of interventions due to anomalous genetics or the short-term time horizon that might be in an okay place. But what about all the broken shells lying around? And even the outliers are going to be broken eventually. They just might be one of those bombs that takes 5 years to go off.
I think the other challenge on this too is thinking about like the systemic NCAA institutional policies that we have too. And it's, I actually, you think about the coaching staff, and the coaching staff is graded and rewarded and probably keeps their positions based off of NCAA championships, based off of, you know, all of these different metrics. And I think it's also important that we look at this from a systemic standpoint and say, like, how can we incentivize coaches to have long-term athletes that go on to have long-term success, athletes that have long-term happiness and perform? Yeah. And I think it's really important that we start quantifying those other variables and start rewarding coaching staff with those metrics because they're just as important as NCAA championships.
Yeah, and this isn't a problem of one program. I think it's really important for us to be clear on that. Like, we're not saying that this was even ill intent necessarily. I think that this was a very bad use of science that was wrong, but who knows what it's exactly.
I was just going to say, we are reading a report and this might just be the tip of the iceberg or it might be the full iceberg and we don't know. And I think it's important to also caveat that.
Yeah, but we do know it's a broader cultural problem within running that is starting to get changed, but it's not changed yet clearly. And so what we really want to emphasize here through those four points is that if you are out there pushing the margins of human performance, you do not have to play the game that Oregon was playing. When we say eat enough always, what we're saying is that that is one of the independent variables. If you throw enough fuel into the fire, and if you train hard, you'll be able to have adaptation cycles that last not just a month, not just a year. You're talking year over year after over year. And that's when you see the magical things you're able to accomplish. But it'll never happen if that bomb goes off because you didn't treat your body well, trying to play around with these math equations that just don't work.
I also think at the end of the day, what I think about too is just how brave those six athletes were for coming forward and saying, like, you know, they're at this institution and this is like their athletic future. And it's really beautiful and amazing to see them come forward. But I also think that, like, if you are out there and these conversations start, whether it's like with a coach, a family member, a friend, just speaking up in a loving way early on, like, I think it's just so important and so valuable. Because I think for me, you know, I do a lot of research in this field, and I feel like sometimes I get too comfortable in the mindset that, of course, everyone understands, like, we should eat enough always. That's what's most important for longevity and performance. But I think the reality is, like, there's still a lot of work to be done. Yeah. And it takes people like these six athletes to speak up and share their experiences and to do so, you know, first in a loving way. And then if that doesn't work, in a more demanding way. Yeah. And I think it's just like really proud of athletes for doing that.
Yeah, it's so cool. I mean, all of this that we're seeing in the report, it's superstition that is masquerading as science. And the time for superstition has to end now. And it's time to go to the science driven by ideally women like Megan and Dr. Emily Krauss and others that understand this firsthand. But all of us have a role to play, which is anytime we see this type of conversation happening, it's okay to step up and speak out, amplify other voices. Like, this matters, not just for performance, but also for long-term health. So the big segue that kind of gets my gears going the most here is that we are not math equations. Like, humans are not math equations, not when you're thinking about performance, certainly when you're thinking about mental health or health more generally. It's so much more complicated than that. And I think anyone kind of knows that. But sometimes maybe when coaches are thinking from the outside and trying to control the uncontrollable, they grasp onto little itty bitty things they can make into math equations. And sometimes they can make that fit a curve, even if it's not driving the curve to begin with.
And I think what made me think about this topic as well, so we've been reading Alexi Pappas's book, Brady.
So it's good.
So good. Reading it in the sauna together. It's fantastic. And she actually, so she talks about the idea, and she learned about this from her psychiatrist. And she talks about the idea of having a personal law. Yeah. And I thought this was fascinating. So in this, a personal law gets at the idea that, like, subconsciously our minds think something might be true based off of prior experience.
Yeah.
And we want to prove those personal laws true. And I was a little bit, at first, it took me a second to kind of like grasp onto that concept. And Alexi used the example of food poisoning. So thinking about, like, if you have food poisoning to a food and then you go and eat that food in the future, your body has this visceral reaction thinking that, like, the food that you've just eaten is going to be like the food that caused the food poisoning. And that's how she describes personal law. And I think a lot of times in life, like, we go through life trying to prove our personal laws true. Yeah. No matter, like, where they come from, or no matter what they're based off of in reality.
Yeah, they're laws. So our brain thinks they're
true. Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. As she was describing the food thing, I was thinking about mine, which I thought I was impervious to this. I like food so fucking much. I mean, as I've been telling you, I look forward to protein cereal all day long. So imagine what else I look forward to. I will eat like an olive and be like, oh, well, that's heaven on earth right there. And what it is for me is pumpkin seeds.
Ooh.
Yeah.
So, I remember you got really sick.
So I got like a thing of pumpkin seeds at a gas station or something. You know, like the ones that they sell that are like, or maybe it was, there's like the big, like, wide ones, not the like really cooked ones. And it made me so violently sick for some odd reason.
I'm pretty sure it wasn't the pumpkin seeds. Yeah. I'm pretty sure you probably, it's like when someone is like, oh, come on over to my house. I've just had food poisoning. And I'm like, I'm pretty sure you've had a stomach virus. And I'm not going to come over to your house.
But either way, just looking at a pumpkin now, it's a terrible season for me because it makes me feel very ill. So it definitely applies to me. Do you have any like that?
Actually, I do. I was just thinking, so I had back at Duke at the Refectory. Do you remember that cafe?
Oh, yeah.
I got really, really sick after having, it was like this like salmon wrap. Uh-huh. It was delicious. It was so good. Got so sick after it. And I was like, oh my gosh, I have food poisoning.
Yeah.
And then I infected all my roommates with the stomach flu and my family at home. And it was definitely not food poisoning.
Actually, I remember the Refectory. We haven't talked about that place in a while. We used to go there after we did some of our shuffle doubles back at Duke. And one time we got a salad And in our salad was just a number of worms. Was, remember those little worms?
It was an organic salad.
Yeah.
It was organic matter.
And protein, bitches. So she has this great quote talking about that, relating it to food poisoning. The brain behaves similarly with emotional trauma. When we create a personal response to trauma, the law can become hardwired into your brain so strongly that when you encounter even vaguely similar situations much later, your mind reacts with irrational intensity.
Okay, first of all, I loved how you just said irrational intensity, yeah. Crushing the reading game. But I think that's, I actually think that's the most important point of it all, though, is the fact that this is irrational intensity. But I think when people go through it, and I know when I've gone through it before, it doesn't feel irrational. Yeah. Like, it's like, this is a personal law. It feels so true.
Well, I think it's a rational response that comes with irrational intensity. Like, ooh. It governs parts of your physiology, not just your psychology and like, as she described her own personal depression that was being triggered by some of this, including, you know, her personal role relates to her mom and everything we talked about last week. As she talks about that, she's like, her body shut down. She was unable to sleep. It was governing all of her daily actions. And, you know, it made me think, personal laws made me think a lot about my own life and how I think about things. And I've worked through this with mental health professionals as well, but like, I think one of my personal laws based on my behavior, my history, should I mention this?
You should.
I think you know what I'm going to talk about.
You should definitely talk about this.
So when I was growing up, my mom, who's one of the best humans in the world, I love her so fucking much and I owe her everything, but she was dealing with depression. You know, not as severe as what Alexi's mom was going through, but at times it was very bad. And as a result, and it was at the time, like I was 8 or so and a little bit beyond that. And it's turned me into thinking that if I am letting someone down in any way, I am a total failure. And I apply that to everything. Like if Megan and I are doing a podcast, which might be a little bit topical for our last edit, and I feel like I screw something up, I'm like, are you mad at me?
And I'm like, of course not. You did great.
Or coaching or anything. And it's been a process working through that. And the funny thing is, not funny, but the interesting thing is, you know, when I say my mom is the most delightful person on earth, I mean, she is. Like,
she's so delightful.
She fills every room she's in with so much love. And she had to get medication and things to help that process. But the point being, even though that personal law no longer exists at all and with the person that might have stemmed from, it still influences my actions every single day. And that's kind of weird to think about how that applies in our brains and how we're doing that. We're creating new personal laws all the time or dealing with old ones all the time, in that these are responses of irrational intensity are kind of governing all of our behavior.
Yeah. I mean, it's wild to kind of like take a deep dive into that with my own self. And then also to think about people like friends, family members, like relationships,
and
people that have been struggling with their own personal laws. I think for me, I think about the idea, you know, I was out running 2 years ago, ruptured my high hamstring. And I think as a result now, every time I get a little niggle or a little just like injury that pops up, I'm like, is this going to be the next hamstring? Or like same with my back, you know, I have this autoimmune thing. I'm like, well, when is my knee going to blow up? When is my back going to blow up? And so I think it's like just like a hyper awareness of little niggles in the body and applying the personal law, like, oh, this is going to be a rupture, or, oh, this is going to be, you know, bilateral sacroiliitis, or like one of the weird health things that I've dealt with.
How have you worked through those feelings? Because I imagine it's going to peak up, you know, it's a little turtle head is going to come out of the shell every single time you wake up and something hurts.
Oh, that sounds like a cute turtle, but in reality, it's a very nefarious turtle. It's not cute like that. It doesn't pop its head out of its shell. It comes raging out of the shell and is like, Megan, I'm gonna fuck you. that's how that nefarious turtle works. But I think
instead of a snapping turtle, we got a fucking turtle.
Oh my God. So much better.
Stay far away.
Where's that species? I think for me, I've just kind of like talked about it openly. I think like talking about it openly with you has been really helpful. And then also just like looking and like kind of like reversing course on patterns and like understanding that this is a personal law I've crafted and just kind of having trust when I can.
Yeah. And what I love about and that's exactly what Alexi was talking about, is that, you know, often your actions and things are what drives these thoughts and feelings. And she talked about the specific behaviors and directions of that. But you know, it gets to how she actually cultivates new personal laws on top of her old ones. Because, you know, everything that creates us, we should love. That doesn't mean you can't change. It doesn't mean that, like, even though you're perfect now, doesn't mean you can't, you know, evolve your perfection over time.
I actually think that point that you just made about like crafting these new personal laws, I think what I've done, and it actually makes me think about what I truly have done, is that I've loved biking and I've loved these other forms. So it's like, I think I took it one step where it was like, okay, I'm going to be super injured and then I'm going to be sad about being injured. And it's like, actually, no, like I can't, in some situations, I can't control being super injured or like rupturing a hamstring or having bilateral sacroiliitis, but I can control like my emotional response to that. And I know that if that happens again, I'm going to freaking love biking or arm biking or like whatever the heck that it is I'm doing or writing manuscripts.
Yeah. As long as we can
crushing email bitches.
No matter what, we can still eat our worms.
Yeah. Oh, so true.
So her quote on this is fucking beautiful. That's what being a bravey is. You are making a conscious choice to tell yourself what you'd like to be until it becomes a part of you.
Whoa.
Yeah.
That's a wisdom bomb.
Is it Plato or Socrates? Oh gosh, I should have actually looked this up before. That was like character is an act of habit. That essentially you are embodying this thing enough that it becomes who you are.
That's a good question. We're going to have to do a 50-50 coin split.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm going to Socrates.
It's actually ludicrous. a little bit different there. And it's what we're really trying to do as coaches too. It's that like we try to tell athletes that everything we are looking for is already inside of you. That's why we don't tinker at the edges or anything like that. Like already there is this wonderful, incredible, everything about it is perfect. Sometimes it might be like sculpting where you need to remove the things around the outside that might be preventing it from shining all the time, but it's already there. And that's the beautiful thing that we can work from.
And my hope is that as a coach, like that is, I feel like the inherent role of a coach is to help people unlock what's already inside of them and to help find like those positive associations and relationships. But it brings me back actually to the University of Oregon situation, because I think about like the outsized role of coaches in people's lives. Like I think back to some of the really impactful coaches I've had and they've changed my life trajectory, but it also comes with like, with a lot of power, comes a lot of responsibility. And it makes me think about the idea that like, if we have like the more education we can have for coaches and the more like open conversation we can have on these topics, like hopefully that sets personal trajectories in a much like better directory.
I love that. Directory.
Directory. Direction.
That was great. Trajectories, directory, refractory, worms. But seeing you say that reminds me of a coach that was incredibly meaningful to me. I didn't talk to you about this, but, and we don't really talk about it much. Jerry Alexander. So I'm sure some people that run for the GRC are listening to this, which is a DC based running club. But the first times I was ever doing workouts directed by a running coach, he was there at the track. And every single time that he would write emails, they were always infused with humor and love. And every single race, he was talking about how proud he was or how it was building for the future or anything like that. And even though I didn't think I was impressionable or whatever, I didn't think I was looking for that. There's a reason that Swap formed right around that time, and that it formed with a very similar tone. At first, when I didn't know who I was, it formed with this tone of like, guys, we're going out there, we're going to run hard, and we're going to celebrate no matter what. And it's really interesting to think about the outsized role coaches play. And that's why the Oregon thing, I think, is so tragic and heartbreaking. Not just because it's a misinterpretation of science, but because the coach is in a position where not only will they reignite old traumas, they will start new ones. And, you know, it's high stakes. And I'm sure, I know I've messed up in the past on a number of different topics, and I'll keep messing up. But hopefully the athletes know it's coming from a place of good intent, where I want what's best for them and things like that. The hard part about the NCAA is that it might be coming from a place of, we need to win an NCAA championship. And that creates a mixed incentive structure that can be really, really difficult.
Really challenging. And I think it's fascinating when you combine the idea about personal laws and to combine the idea about like coaches. And just, I think like when you think about the idea that like, I hope as coaches that we're helping athletes craft their own personal laws, starting from a point of like eating enough always is important.
Yeah.
And that weight is not a independent variable in the context of performance. And I think, I really hope that like, you know, that can become more of a norm in conversation.
Yeah. Yeah. So as we think about this and we're evolving all of our own personal laws, just remember, you're fucking awesome. And don't let anyone tell you that you need to change yourself for reasons that are related to things like body composition. That's not how it works. We can refer you a million different studies on this topic. And I think putting that into your training will not just lead to like avoiding traumas in the future, it'll also lead to way better performance over time.
I agree. I also think this parallels and segues into an awesome question that we got from a listener on the idea about coaching and the relationship between coaching and leadership and just kind of principles that apply to both. This is from M. M said, here's a question for you that I've been noodling on. I'm curious how you think about about yourself as a coach. More so, do you worry or wonder how folks perceive you? And if so, what have you done to keep yourself honest to being you and what you think is most important? The context, I've never been in such a highly visible leadership role as I am now, and I am all of a sudden really aware that I care about how I'm being perceived. working through the not caring as much, but more so focusing on the kind of leader I want to be and being that. Anywho, I'm asking other leaders and coaches how they've worked through that. And this is from M.
Such a good question.
That's such a good question.
And I think super applicable. Like we can learn from everyone else on this topic too, but I think for both of us, so for context, you know, for me, it's been coaching. I was editor in chief of a law journal. I was hiring attorney at a firm. Megan, you're not just one of the best coaches. You're one of the best researchers. You organize all of these projects. You've actually had, you know, involvement with things like the Pac-12 on these big research topics. So we're coming from a lot of different roles to think about how we engage with others in this field.
And I think the beauty of having a lot of different roles is it makes you think about the context in which True. Like you're being both a leader and then also like a follower and yeah. like being a part of a team. And I love like one of the greatest gifts I feel like is getting to work with a mentor that shows you like an incredible way to mentor. And I have a few mentors like that at Stanford. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this is such a gift. Like, thank you for that.
Are there any specific mentors? This wasn't on our, you know, that we went and talked about this, but are there any specific mentors that jumped to mind for you?
A bunch. Actually, one I can think of immediately is a mentor, Kristen, who's an epidemiologist at Stanford. And she is such a boss. Like, I love how she does a lot of things outside of Stanford. And I love how like she is 100% in her work at Stanford.
Yeah.
And then also like has an ability to put her work in a box and be a brilliant writer and speaker and, you know, be an advocate for science in so many other areas. And then all at the same time, having this like awesome balance and perspective about like, what is science and what are the boundaries of science?
It's her work in a box, work in a box, girl. Sorry, what you said was extremely meaningful and I came with my dick in a box jokes. So thinking about this topic, for me, it reminds me of this great Ted Lasso quote from the very first episode, I believe. And this is what Ted Lasso says. He thinks he's mad now, wait till we win him over. And when I heard that quote, I paused it, I turned to Megan, and I was like, my life's totally changed. Like that to me hit me right in the feels. And the reason is that what Ted Lasso is saying there is that he is so committed to his principles that he's not waiting for approval from someone else to do that. And the reason that that's such a journey for me is that when I started out, I was unsure. You know, I was coming into coaching in this context of like, oh, well, there's all these established coaches. I mean, I don't have an exercise physiology degree. I think I know a lot, but do I? What's going on? And into that sphere, I put articles out and coached athletes and all these different things, and then would hear shit being said about me that was just caustic and mean and wrong. And I knew it was wrong, but other people didn't know it was wrong. And it made me so self-conscious and made me want to appease those people. And I specifically remember, I think this was like 2015 or something, writing an article and being like, okay, this person is your audience. This person is reading it. This person that does not like me. And I'm like, what the fuck am I doing with my life? And it's been a process since then, but I can confidently say, I do not give a fuck anymore. And I am more in Ted Lasso. Think he's mad now, wait till we win him over. And I think we haven't won over everyone. We haven't won over this person, but we've won over a lot of people.
I absolutely love that. I think for me too. So sometimes I really think about the idea of like being authentic as you're talking about like in these leadership positions. But I think also what it comes down to is sometimes when I think about, like, I think it's important to acknowledge like, oh my gosh, like sometimes as a coach or as a mentor or as a leader, you actually have a lot of like power over people. And it's really important to be careful with that and like to hold that lightly. But I think sometimes like I have seen, and maybe I've seen this myself or other people, that sometimes when you're trying too hard to be in a leadership role, it actually feels really forced. And you're trying to be that like perfect leader and mentor. And I think like the authenticity should come in the context of the role itself. And I think that's something that like I often think about. But Brené Brown, incredible person. I feel like whenever you talk about like leadership and authenticity, if you don't cite Brené Brown, it's like, who else are you citing? But I was listening to her podcast last week and she had a great quote. And this is from James Hollis from his book, What Matters Most. And as I'm quoting this, I realize this is like Brené Brown quoting James Hollis, which I feel like a lot to me feels a lot like Michael Scott quoting Wayne Gretzky. This is the exact same situation.
You miss every shot you don't take.
Yes, exactly.
Michael Scott, Wayne Gretzky.
And Brené said, or James Hollis said, we are not here to fit in, be well-balanced, or provide exemplar for others. We are here to be eccentric, different, perhaps strange, perhaps merely to add our small piece, our little clunky, chunky selves to the great mosaic of being. as the gods intended, we are here to become more and more ourselves. And I love that in the context of leadership too, of just leading from like what authentically feels right, yeah, with the idea of like, I just want to be kind and support people. And I feel like that's an incredible path of leadership that doesn't have to be so like calculated and, yeah, planned and like thinking about all the different nuances of leadership.
And our clunky chunky selves.
Yeah. How cool, right, is that? Like, it's like
the embracing every little imperfection about yourself. Was it Siri Lindley, Coach Siri Lindley, amazing triathlete coach, that talks about authenticity, like relentless or fearless authenticity?
Fearless authenticity. Yeah.
And, you know, I think the hard part is knowing what is authentic to you. But when we were thinking about great leaders that we truly admire, authenticity we kept coming back to, and enthusiasm we kept coming back to, and the interplay of those two things. And I think thought exercise, think about the leader you admire the most. It doesn't have to be in running. It can be in politics. It can be in your work or anything. And they're almost always bringing that enthusiasm. And I think what changes leadership, the authenticity in leadership, away from the authenticity in being like a normal human that isn't expecting others to follow their advice, is you have to be like rock and rolling and ready to go, because that's how you get people to follow you and believe in what you're doing. You know, you have to sprint forward in the directions you want to go. That's really hard, especially when you're uncertain about yourself. But enthusiasm, I think, kind of has to guide the way. And something I think about all the time.
And I think some of the best mentors and some of the best relationships that I've had with mentors in the process are the mentors that are like enthusiastically curious, yeah, about like me as a person, or like, what are my questions? And I think like, I try to be that way now, like, you know, leading teams or in coaching process. It's like, tell me more about yourself. Like, I want it. Like, I'm fascinated from that, from like a psychological standpoint, from like a kindness standpoint, from just like wanting to be curious about humans and, yeah, like what, you know, what are all the different human forces we have, like, you know, connecting us. And I think that's so cool, is like, I try to be really efficient in meetings. Like,
yeah,
you know, I'm like all about like 20 or 30 minute meetings, but I would love like the first 5 or 10 minutes of meetings. Awesome to get to know people and like to like figure out like what makes them tick, like what's their life story.
I love that. Yeah. It probably goes both directions, like their life story, but then also being open to discussions that might go outside of like, this is just what you need to know.
Yes.
The big step for me has been like, as long as criticism comes from a place of love, it is very helpful. And that's been tough given my personal laws that we just talked about. But to leave you with a little thought experiment, you know, there's been a lot of articles written about why Trump resonated so much, whereas the Trump impersonators have not resonated in the same way, especially on the national level. And I think it really gets back to this enthusiasm and authenticity perspective. So a lot of them have enthusiasm, but what Trump has is he is authentically an asshole. He's authentically the worst.
That's incredible.
And I think people really like that. Meanwhile, all the Trump impersonators that are out there, they're just not authentic with it. Like,
They're not authentic.
Josh assholes. Hawley. Yeah, they're not authentic. Well, I think they're assholes, but they're not assholes in the very specific, stupid way. And so as you're thinking about it, like, obviously don't like ruin the world with your, you know, authenticity if you're like doing bad things, but really embrace all the little clunky, chunky parts of yourself. For me, it's humor. It's going all out and putting myself out there and being like all over the top. For you, I would say, I mean, is it okay if I characterize what it is for you?
Go for it. Yeah.
Like extreme curiosity, this ability to engage with anyone, to make anyone feel like they're the only person in the world because they are to you. Like I've seen you do that in your mentorship roles and it's been so cool to me. Is there any others that you think of for yourself? I know that's an awkward question.
Oh, thank you. Well, I think actually I love the point that you made about like direct, giving people like direct feedback and,
yeah,
coming at it with like a place of love. And like, I'm curious for you. Like, this is like what I want for you. This is like, you know, I hope you're like, you know, giving feedback just in that context of love. But I also think too, it's about like giving it directly to that person.
Yeah.
So I think I've been on some team dynamics where someone comes in and they're like, it's one person giving you feedback and they're like, oh, we think this. And I'm like, who is the we in this situation? Like, are you talking about me behind your back? And so I think it's also just having this like really direct person-to-person communication. And then on team structures, like avoiding that like behind the back, like,
yeah,
you know, talking about someone behind their back. It's like, no, just make all of that direct and upfront and in person. I think it just helps a lot.
I love that. So zooming out and thinking back to, you know, University of Oregon and all of that, you know, I think the as that relates to leadership more generally, and as it relates to Bravey, the big concern is that you're presented in this role where people are following you, and it's this great like responsibility. And as you are faced with that responsibility, if your authentic, enthusiastic self causes harm for others, it is not okay. And so that's why an important exercise to do, I think, for anyone that's leading is like write down what your core principles are and embody those core principles. I guarantee if the coach at Oregon did this based on like some good things I've heard about them, it wouldn't say like, you know, I don't care where athletes are when they're 25. It'd be like, I want to create healthy, happy people that have success and reach their potential and do all these things. And then be like, okay, are my actions aligning with those goals? And I just don't think they did in the Oregon case. And it's truly tragic.
I absolutely love that. I'm sitting here like a bobblehead doll, just like, yes, yes, yes. That's so amazing. Also, I think I'm going to add to my core principles protein cereal.
Yeah.
Just to really bring this episode wrapping up. But
my personal law is like a rather gross sludge of protein that I have after every run.
And it's fucking delicious.
Throw some worms in there.
Do you want to go on to listener corner?
Let's do it.
My favorite part of the podcast. Do you want to start with the first one?
Oh my gosh, this is a big one. You're just giving me this as punishment.
I'm like, you can read all this.
Okay, so this is an amazing story that we received from A, and it's called Prancy Pony. So there's backstory of them coaching their son's third and fourth grade team. Fast forward a little bit, and my son's school approached me to say that they had to cut down gym time for elementary students to just once per week. They wondered if I would start an after-school running club for third and fourth graders at the school on Wednesdays. After talking it over with her husband, we decided to go for it. But instead of running workouts, we are playing running games, helping kids learn the basics of running and get some exercise without the pressure of running 3 to 5 miles each practice.
I love that side note.
So perfect. Every time we start off with a group huddle and I share a running tip that we focus on during our game. One of my favorites was a few weeks ago when our running focus was cadence, taking more quick steps to increase speed and reduce injuries. I was channeling your energy with our group chant for the week. And this is my favorite part. Prance like a show pony, our big form tip. All throughout our game, Pony Express, of course, you could hear people yelling, prance like a show pony, take quicker steps, high heel recovery, when they were encouraging their teammates to outrun other teams. Every week on our bus rides to the park, kids shout out our past chants. So prance like a show pony has been echoing ever since. It always makes me think of you and send a little gratitude your way. And then my favorite part of all, this week, our focus was on endurance, not giving up when things get hard. And we did our first 30-minute out and back run with no breaks. Hell yeah. I didn't do that till I was very old. Instead of a game, we tested our limits and saw how far we could go in that time period. This was a major confidence booster for our kids, many of whom struggled to or couldn't run for a quarter mile straight at the beginning of the semester. Thankfully, some teachers and a parent volunteered to help so we could get we could group kids together with similar speeds to make sure no one was left behind. In my group, after our turnaround, it started to get tough. Cramps, heavy breathing, sore muscles, the works. Despite the challenges, my kids were determined to make it running the whole way. But what almost made me cry, in the best of ways, was when I overheard one boy in my group whisper to another boy who was struggling, prance like a show pony. Then they both picked up their feet and kept going. We made it the whole way back, almost 3.5 miles in all. Wow! The farthest that everyone but Gio had ever run before. And we celebrated all the way back to school. Thank you for putting language around ideas that inspire us and the next generation of runners.
That is such a beautiful listener corner. I'm like basically crying over here.
It was really long, but you saw why I wanted to include that, right?
That's just so beautiful. Also, the next time you're pacing me in a race at mile like 40, just whisper in my ear, prance like a show pony.
Do you think that would go over well?
We'll test it out.
That's how the race is going. Yeah, I was like, if you get like a sharp backhand.
Yeah, it's like, nope, a head clunk in the middle of the night. The next one is from Jay, and I love this. It's called Long Run Friends. Your podcast has over time become one of my must-listen favorites. I admit at first, I didn't quite know what to make of your honesty, openness, and sense of humor. Who the fuck are these half-naked, self-crazed weirdos? You're my half-naked, self-crazed weirdos. That's who you are. And I mean that in the most generous way possible. Thanks for being my long-run companions. That's awesome.
Talk about enthusiasm and authenticity.
And sex-crazed humans.
Yeah. So that's our podcast for today. We love you all, every little bit of you, everything about you, especially your bodies, as weird as that is to say, they're perfect the way they are. So rate, review, subscribe, do whatever you do for a podcast. We love you guys.
Woohoo!
Woohoo!
Bye.